Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
It's another Friday afternoon, and you are very welcome to another episode of The Sideshow. On today's show, we have a lady who I have been chasing for a little bit of some time now. She first came across my radar, I guess, when her publishing house, Timber Press, and huge credit to them for making this interview possible, dropped the book through my postbox. The book on this occasion is called All the President's Gardens. It is available in all fine bookstores and online via Timber Press if you just search them, or if you're stuck for anything, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow and sideshow.com. All the President's Gardens, funnily enough, is a gardening book that I categorize as unputdownable, and that in gardening terms is a little bit slightly unusual when you consider that all of the books that I would have in my library are, for the greater part, they are reference books. But when you take something that is just that little bit different, in brackets, yet still horticultural and still gardening, it's quite an achievement and quite an acclaim to be able to say that about anything that is in print, in text, and in writing. All the President's Gardens author Marta McDowell is online. Marta, how are you? Welcome to the Sideshow.
Peter, it's my pleasure to be here.
Marta, I literally have. You are a woman who, if I was a little bit younger and you were in Dublin, I would be trying to woo you from the far side of a dance hall.
You're very kind.
Well, it's a nice acclaim, Marta. We were chatting briefly earlier on, and I was saying that there are some books that are not of horticulture in my library that I had tried to pit you against or put you on that mantelpiece with. And I think the last time I read a book that I could not put down in and read straight away through in the one go was Nick Leeson's story of being the rogue trader and his dealings on behalf of Barings Bank. It was one of those. To achieve that in horticulture and gardening terms, something that is, how would you say it, rarely that controversial, it's quite an achievement, if you'll allow me give you that acclaim.
Well, thank you. I do like a good story as well, so I really tried to seek those out.
Well, let's go back, if we can, a little bit. What is it that you do for a living, Marta?
Sure thing. Well, I write and I garden. I live in Chatham, New Jersey, and I teach landscape history and horticulture at the New York Botanical Garden.
How difficult is it, or is it difficult at all, I would gather, based on your book, not very, to take an entire classroom of young, up-and-coming, vibrant people, and never mind the horticultural part, but just to talk to them about history in itself? Do you find that they are enthused by that?
Well, you know, I do my very best to engage them in a subject that is around them, you know, sort of every minute of every day. Anywhere you are, you're surrounded by design of the space. And whatever they end up doing for a living, you know, whether they're doing, you know, hydroponic growing of vegetables in urban farm situations, or, you know, designing kind of suburban gardens, or working on historic estates, it's going to be around them. So, well, you know, they seem to like it. By the end, they're all saying, we should do this again.
to the book, Marta, you took a slightly unusual route to, I guess, coming up with this idea.
Well, you know, I have to say, true confessions now, Peter. I used an idea from a student. So, you know, there's that old song about if you become a teacher by your pupils, you'll be taught. And in my case, it was one of my garden history students. His name was Seamus McLennan. And, you know, I had been given this idea by my editor at Timber Press to write a history of American gardening, which sounded so huge and so kind of overwhelming. That I thought back to Seamus's final project for my class, and he had done, you know, a little history, a look, 10-minute presentation, a little paper on the history of the White House grounds. And it was fascinating because it showed all of these different styles and horticultural techniques kind of compacted into this one nice package. And so I thought, I could use that. So Seamus was kind enough to let me do that. So that's how it all got started.
To your credit, Seamus is noted and thanked in the intro to your book. Let's get into the book then, if we can, Marta, because I sat in bed, I'll be honest with you, I'd been out for a couple of pints of Guinness the night before. I woke up the next morning, a Sunday morning, and I had a cup of coffee in my hand, and the book kind of followed me around the house, and I pretty much dropped it down, I think, the next evening, having gone through just about the entire thing in the one blast. It's a long time since something like that has happened to me. But what intrigued me was how you started the book, which was before the White House was even built and the choosing of the site.
Well, you know, it was an interesting site in terms of sort of who had gardened there first. So if you think about Jamestown, so the first colony here of English who come up the Potomac, Captain John Smith, a little boat full of guys, and they're exploring, right? I think they're hoping to find gold, really, or at least a passage to the Spice Isles. But they do encounter agriculture. So we're organized agriculture among America's first gardeners. And they were growing things that became very influential to, you know, our mutual history, like tobacco, but also food crops. And then, you know, I move on from there to how does our nation's capital end up in this area that is, you know, sort of farmland and swamp by the time you get up to, you know, the late 1700s. And so that was a big political wrangle, but it does end up down there, and the first president of the United States, George Washington, designs this city from scratch with the help of a Frenchman and British design manuals, and I guess the president's house itself with an Irish architect named James Hoban.
Let's get into that then if we can, Marta, because there is a really strong UK and Irish connection with the White House. I guess from an Irish side of things, we're probably about the only country in the planet that has a one-day pass access all areas. And from the UK side of it, I mean, if we go to Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Queen Elizabeth II, I mean, it's literally in there from the very, very start and all the way throughout the far side.
Oh, it absolutely is. So, you know, Washington, who designed this city that ended up with his name, he had a shelf full of British design manuals. So he had Philip Miller's Garden Dictionary. He had a design book by Batty Langley. And he was following those principles when he lays out, you know, where the president's house will be, sort of up on this rise looking out over the river. And then, you know, John Adams, who's the first president to actually occupy the house, had visited so many English gardens, along with Thomas Jefferson, while he was ambassador to the court of St. James.
From an Irish point of view, how strong is that, and how has that influenced in there as well, Marta?
Well, James Hoban, the original architect of the White House, was from Ireland, and what I've read is that he based the design on a sort of famous Irish house. And you'll have to help me with a pronunciation, Peter. Is it Leinster House? Leinster House?
Leinster House it is indeed, yes.
Leinster House in Dublin. And then, you know, more from my point of view, because I always remember my mother saying we were not lace curtain Irish, meaning our ancestors came in and worked. I had a grandfather who was a miner. A lot of the people who built the president's house were Irish immigrants. You know, not all. There were certainly enslaved Africans and Scottish and other people as well, but there were certainly their share of Irish immigrants.
Would they all have been noted, Marta? Because I would gather a lot of them would have been, how do I say it, in today's terms, maybe off the record.
I think a lot of them were indentured, and the records are a little sketchy in terms of, you know, who the actual laborers were. So I know some of the Scottish masons, the more skilled people, are listed, and a lot of the other people were putting in the labor. And while the United States government never owned slaves, they did hire them out from other local owners, so they certainly used them. And I'm sure that the Irish indentured were that in that way as well, that they were temporary labor force. They weren't lace curtain Irish either.
No, let's go a slightly different direction if we can, because if I even take the line that you have on the front of the book, it's Madison's cabbages to Kennedy's roses. I would gather, Marta, that the White House has tended to follow maybe trends, or that trends have changed the gardens that have ended up in the White House depending on which president was in place and also era. How does that bit work out?
Yeah, I found it really interesting, Peter, that the presidency and the White House, and certainly the grounds that surround it, are kind of a fashion funnel, right? You have all of the popular culture kind of swirling around, but somehow it does end up being displayed in an interesting sequence by the time you have the president and the first families and their gardeners living there. So early on, they were, again, it was very much influenced by that tug of the formal kind of French and then the more romantic, we still call it English landscape style, that was bubbling up. And in terms of what they grew, you know, Madison's original plant orders, so just around, you know, kind of 1810, let's say, he was ordering things that, you know, some of which I still grow in my garden, so roses and lilacs and Rose of Sharon, lots of trees, but he was also ordering lots of seeds, you know, things that I tend to plant more in my community garden patch, my allotment, you'd say. So cabbages and turnips and beets and, you know, things for the table. And vegetables and fruits were grown on the grounds really up till almost the 20th century. And then there was a break when that was kind of less fashionable.
Is it fair to suggest then, and when and historically in Ireland and in the UK after the First and Second World Wars, there seemed to be a trend there where we went to what we now know, I guess, as growing your own, or what is maybe now known or referred to as allotmenteering, which might not have been considered that, let's say, back around the 1917, 1921, 1940s or so, because I guess it wasn't a case of growing your own, let's say, as for a hobby. It was more as growing your own food for necessity's sake.
You know, as I mentioned, you get up to around the turn of the 20th century, and vegetable growing is, you know, it's kind of out of style. You know, it's that Victorian period, everybody's growing these very big, elaborate pattern beds and big ornamentals, and not so much fruit and vegetables anymore. During the wars, during the Second World War, there was a small victory garden back at the White House during the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt period. But prior to that, I read someone had said, well, the only thing we grow in terms of food at the White House is mint for the iced tea. You know, so we've gone to just no vegetables at all. And then after the Roosevelt Victory Garden, I don't think vegetables were grown again until Michelle Obama puts them in 2009. And so there's this big, you know, pendulum sort of swinging back and forth over time, you know, and now we all hope, you know, gardeners hope that that vegetable garden stays as a permanent feature of the White House grounds.
Well, let's go there, and I don't entirely want to get into politics as such, so we will discount who has ended up as president in 2016 just for the minute. But with your eyes closed, bearing in mind the future, but we're also stepping back a little bit in time, if the A White House is lived in by, let's say, a lady by the name of Hillary, what would you maybe expect, bearing in mind you have an entire history inside your head and inside a very beautiful book as well? What would you expect her garden to be? And I guess if I can ask you that in the same breath, what would you imagine the difference might be between that and, let's say, that of Mr. Trump?
Well, let's say, well, I'll start with the easy one. So during the Clinton administration, when Hillary Clinton was first lady, she sponsored a series of modern American sculpture exhibits that were in the East Garden. And so, you know, different trends from the 20th century represented in sculptural pieces during those 8 years. And I know that the Clintons grew cherry tomatoes up in the solarium, which is on the third floor of the White House. So I think she's very vegetable-friendly. And I doubt there would be that many changes other than that. I think strongly that she would retain the vegetable garden. And it would actually be a little bit harder to take out now, because a few weeks ago, Michelle Obama announced and dedicated some more permanent features to that food garden that were funded by Burpee of Burpee Seeds. It has now three simple wooden arches that University of Virginia architecture students designed, and some more permanent paving and things like that. In terms of if there is a Trump presidency, I'm sure it would be over the top, Peter. May I say that? I mean, honestly, I don't know if he's done any gardening related to any of his properties. And maybe I just need to leave it to all of your listeners' collective imaginations.
Well, yeah. And that's fair enough. I'll go watch a couple of episodes of the Marx Brothers, and we'll put that one entirely just to one side, because as you know, what rightly well on the Sideshow, we do not discuss politics. We don't want to get into this, and this is a fictitious conversation about the decision that has already been made, but the garden decisions obviously aren't top of that list just yet. Let's move swiftly on from that delightful matter, if we can, Marta, and thank you so much. Curiosity killed the cat. Whilst we're talking about extravagancy, over the couple of hundred years, what were the ones or whose were the gardens, and what were those gardens that surprised you the most, where you turned around and went, holy good God, they did what?
Well, I will say I was amazed, may I say floored, by the extent of the glass houses, the conservatories, that were stuck on to the west side of the White House, really starting sort of late 1850s, 1860s, and all the way up to 1900. So the entire second half of the 19th century, where today there's the West Wing and, you know, the Oval Office, very, you know, famous parts of the White House, there were glass houses. And so they had display conservatories, they had a orchid house, they had a rose house, they had a violet house. They propagated all of the, you know, bedding plants and the cut flowers for the use of the White House. And, you know, so it was this very elaborate period that is kind of forgotten. And I was just astounded at the extent of them, and, you know, really quite over the top. So
did it get really grand, Marta? Because like in my head, and you know, sitting in Ireland and on the far side of the road from me is literally farmland, County Nowhere, and it is green fields as you would picture it. And not so much that I am naive, but, you know, of what we're told and of what we've been told over the years, and the reaction of when Obama came to Ireland, when he stood outside College Green in Dublin, and you're watching the crowd and people literally handing them their children. And I mean, if, to be honest with you, if Barack had decided to walk off with a couple of them, you know, I'm sure people would have been secretly delighted. I jest in saying that, but the most powerful man, it literally in the planet, you can have anything you want in the world. I mean, how grand are we talking?
Well, let's see. So it happened over a period of time. So it started pre American Civil War. So again, you know, kind of earlier in the 1800s, pretty simply, where, you know, a president might want to have table grapes, for example, off season, right? So what do? You have a glass house, right? The same way you might have a cucumber frame if you don't have a long enough growing season. But then you get up to someone like James Buchanan, who's right before Abraham Lincoln, and he puts a proper display conservatory on for his first lady, who was actually his niece, because James Buchanan was a bachelor. And so that gets a little more into fashion and style, and just because I want to have it. You know, when you go later in the 19th century, and it is that kind of gilded age, so things do get fancier, you know, and you do start to have these collections showing up at the White House of various kinds of exotic plants. So there was one quote from some horticultural newspaper at the time that he visited the White House and he saw these beds of, you know, 75 different varieties of crotons, these, you know, kind of fussy, bright-colored tropical plants. You know, and he's bragging about that. Like, isn't that a wonderful thing that there are these, you know, all these 75 varieties? And plants were coming in from all over the world, into the UK and into America. And, you know, it was really driven by this desire to collect and to have, you know, sort of these great quantities of different varieties of things. There really was a kind of bigger is better and more is better sort of philosophy that goes on until just about the turn of the 20th century. And then you get back into kind of what we call colonial revival, which is much simpler. And that's also when the glass houses go away. So again, that, you know, that little fashion pendulum is swinging again.
Was there one that maybe underwhelmed you where you turned around and went, are you joking me? The most powerful man in the world went and did that? What was he?
Yes, so here's one. The Harrisons, so Benjamin Harrison and his first lady, Caroline Harrison, who were, again, towards the end of the 19th century, so before Teddy Roosevelt, they wanted to triple the size of the White House. So they were going to take the current building, think, you know, if you can sort of picture that in your mind, they were going to build another one of those that would just act as a museum, and then they were going to build two gigantic glass houses, you know, think like the Crystal Palace, and they were going to join them up all with sort of these long passageway glass houses and have a giant courtyard with a big fountain in the middle. And I mean, I looked at it and thought, oh, thank God they didn't, you know, pass the appropriation for that. It would have been a monstrosity.
even in today's terms, that would have been a monstrosity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Marta, you are also, while I have you, you're also the author of Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life. Can you tell me briefly how that one all works? I was so very intrigued when I actually got into that a little bit more.
Oh, well, you know, that was a real labor of love, Peter. But I wish I could say it was because I read a lot of Beatrix Potter as a child. That would be totally false. I did not read The Tale of Peter Rabbit until I was well into adulthood. But once I discovered Beatrix Potter and her, like the kind of breadth of her artistic endeavors, her scientific interests, and her interest in conservation, and just her personality, which she was an absolute hoot. I really fell for her. And so I had so much fun writing that book. You may not know this, but there is something called the Beatrix Potter Society. And it is the most interesting, diverse, just lovely group of people you can imagine from all over the place. And, you know, different people helped me with that. It was really a lot of fun. So I went from Beatrix Potter to the president. Can you imagine?
But this is the thing. Like when I read the book, I was kind of going, okay, fair enough. What type of, you know, I don't mean that in a bad way, but what type of lady collects, you know, has a collection of Proteas? Or the two don't really join, if you don't mind me suggesting, Marta.
It was an interesting track. So I had always been writing about, I call it the pen and the trowel. So people who are writers and people who garden. And so switching to doing this, you know, sort of broader kind of survey book was different. But I found I could put together, you know, kind of assemble. I kind of think of it as like a patchwork quilt. I could assemble this story that would hopefully be as interesting to people about the history of American gardening as the history and, you know, sort of garden biography of Beatrix Potter. So that's what I set out to do.
I need to get my hands on that one just for the sake of just figuring out how it all pieced together. It surprised me, and I was delighted to see it. And it was one of those of my head was saying, why did she write this book? And then the more I got into it, I kind of said, right, okay, I need to get myself, and hopefully, fingers crossed, I know it's being published and it's a little bit older than All the President's Gardens, but at the same token, I wouldn't mind going into it in a little bit more detail, just from a personal perspective. What does the future hold for you, Marta? How is the book going, and what are you up to next?
Well, you know, the book's going well. You know, I go around, as authors tend to do, and talk to groups about this topic and why they should, you know, be interested in it. So I'm doing a lot of that. And I've been working on a new book. So I'm in the editorial process with a manuscript about an American author named Laura Ingalls Wilder. And she wrote a popular series of juvenile books, including Little House on the Prairie, which is probably her best known, because there was a television series about that one. So I'm back to doing this pen in the trowel. You know, it's her and the plants she mentions, her garden interests, the different places she lived, and sort of her life in that sense.
Okay, well, the book All the President's Gardens by Marta McDowell, author also of Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life. You should get your hands on a copy of that if you can. Madison's Cabbages to Kennedy's Roses, How the White House Grounds Have Grown with America. All I can say, it is such an intriguing read. I was absolutely delighted when I got my hands on it. It literally also, for those of you at home listening to this, it has an index in there of almost every single plant that has ever existed in the White House, which is absolutely phenomenal, from the original first gardeners all the way straight away through. The photography in it is to be commended, as I noted on sideshow.com, literally to be commended, from those of QE2 to the Irish influence again across there. They are literally all there where possible in colour. And Marta McDowell, it has been a real pleasure and a real treat to have you on the phone. Thank you so much for coming on the Sideshow.
It's been my pleasure, Peter.
Marta, if people want to get in touch, you are on the Twitter thing. You have a website indeed.
I do. They can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Marta McDowell. And there's a website as well, martamcdowell.com.
And I should note, for those of you listening, that's M-A-R-T-A. There's no H in Marta on this occasion. That's an in-joke that we have, Marta, at this stage of the game.
That's right. And I think I should finish, Peter, with a quote from the White House gardener who held that office for the longest time, Irv Williams. He was the White House head gardener for 45 years. And what he once said was, "What's great about the job is that our trees, our shrubs, our plants know nothing about politics."
Marta McDowell, thank you so much. You are an absolute lady. It has been a privilege and an honor.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.
And that was the very brilliant and amazing Marta McDowell. Thank you so much to Marta, to Bessie at Timber Press for absolutely everything. It has been a real pleasure and a real treat. The book is higher than highly recommended. All good bookstores, go buy it now. And if you know a gardener, you could not ask for a better gift to bestow upon them. Is that the right way to put that? I think it is. In the meantime, anything else you might need, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow and Sideshow.com. We're also on Instagram and in iTunes, where you can leave a rate and a review. You who own Sideshow t-shirts, however, we shall see you December the 10th in Dublin City Centre for the Christmas soiree of the Sideshow kind. Enjoy. Take care. Salon. Bye-bye.